for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Shoplifting has reached almost epidemic proportions. Over 1 million shoplifting offenses are committed each year in the U.S. alone. But some of its perpetrators argue it's not a crime, it's a disease. To explain the history and contradictions of shoplifting, here in the studio, Rachel Steyer. She's associate professor at the theater school at DePaul University. She's author of a new book. It's titled The Steal. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've subtitled this book, A Cultural History of Shoplifting. Has the culture of shoplifting changed over the years?
Yes, definitely. That was one of the things that drew me to the topic, these different forms that shoplifting takes through the ages, from when we first see it in Shakespeare's day, the beginning of modern consumption, the beginning of luxury products in stores in London, the beginning of people wanting those products and not having enough money to buy them, but seeing other people on the street wearing them and seeing people in their houses having them. That is the beginning of shoplifting in London. Then we go to the 19th century, kleptomania. It becomes a disease with the advent of Freud and his disciples in the beginning of modern psychology and the idea of the unconscious and these things propelling us over which we have no control, these urges driving us. And then jumping forward to the 1960s America, we also have the idea of Abbie Hoffman, Steal This Book, and shoplifting as being part of the revolution against the man. The idea of it being okay to steal from a store. You're not hurting another individual. Rather, you're taking something back for the people is an extremely powerful idea that has a lot of truck today. And then today, what are our ideas about shoplifting? We see shoplifting is an addiction. Many people believe that it's an addiction. We also see a big topic among loss prevention personnel, stores, and law enforcement people is the rise of professional shoplifting gangs. These are gangs of two, three more people who sweep through the store, grab the stuff, and sell it on eBay. And it's cost retail. That particular dimension of shoplifting, these professionals cost retailers quite a bit of money. Those gangs are responsible for the biggest volume in dollars lost because they steal much more, and so on. Anyway, you see just kind of from this survey.
Yeah.
Why it really
has history with legs. And here's some a message already posted on Facebook. Do I understand that this is being treated as a psychological problem in this economy? Families and individuals are under tremendous pressure.
Yes, the writer makes a good point, gets kind of to the heart of one of the debates. Is this a psychological issue or is it driven by economics? I guess today, if you're going to talk about today, I would say both. It's driven by both. Shoplifting has risen in the recession. There's no doubt about that. However, having said that, the things that people tend to shoplift are not loaves of bread a la Jean Valjean. the things people shoplift are either, generally speaking, because of course people shoplift everything, so everything we buy, people shoplift. But some of the most commonly shoplifted items are items that you would find in your local Rite Aid or CVS, like Rogaine, Oil of Olay, Red Bull energy drinks. Even when we go to the grocery store and we talk about what are the most commonly shoplifted items at the grocery store, we're really talking about steak. We're not talking about ground chuck. So I maintain, yes, I think there is a psychological dimension and there is an economic dimension. I think part of the thing about the book that was interesting to me is why do we always have to separate the psychological from the economic when talking about this issue?
You know, I wonder, too, about the celebrity aspect of shoplifting and how that has focused on what could be the psychological aspect, since we assume celebrities have the money to buy whatever they want to buy. Mm-hmm. If so, why are they shoplifting?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are many different reasons why a celebrity might shoplift. I am not a medical doctor. Of course, I am a writer, so I'm speculating here based on my research. But what I would say is, celebrities shoplift for many of the reasons that other people shoplift, because they feel somehow prohibited from something. I would say that generally speaking, shoplifting, it's not a one-on-one relationship. What I mean by that is someone shoplifts because they feel somehow that something has been denied, or they feel somehow like they have been wronged. It might have nothing to do with anything in the store at all. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm not justifying that. I'm simply saying, from talking to a lot of people, this is this is one of the things that I've come to understand about it.
I think listen to this message posted on Facebook by Linda. She says, "I work at a shoe store while attending school full time. It's one thing to see someone swipe a pair of work shoes, but quite another when they walk out with high fashion heels. I find it disgusting that someone will walk out with $500 worth of goods while those of us working are making $10 an hour."
Yeah, I mean, I think this speaks to exactly what I was describing a minute ago, whereby people are drawn to those high-end luxury items, the work boots. They don't, who cares about the work boots? They want the designer branded heels.
And they're not taking into account who might be suffering.
No.
Who is suffering? All of us?
Well, yes. There's a statistic about that that I quote in the book, which is that shoplifting costs American families at least $400 a year. It's like a crime tax. That's a pretty widely accepted statistic. I can tell you, however, from talking with a lot of shoplifters, because shoplifting is done from a store, I think often that statistic does not make a big impact. It's abstract.
It's a store. It's not you.
Yes.
It's not me.
Yes.
It's something that they want or something they feel they must have.
Yes.
And they're not thinking about the consequences to any one other person. But since it's been with us for such a long time, you wonder about how it has figured its way into novels. And you mention Jean Valjean and Les Miserables, and you wonder to what extent it was earlier something that people did because they needed it badly, but now it's become really quite a tradition in this country.
Yes. I mean, Though even when you go back to some of these novels from the 18th century, like Moll Flanders, reading Moll Flanders, she shoplifts, and she shoplifted at a time in England when shoplifting was a hanging crime. You could get hanged for anything more than 5 shillings. Or you might be transported to Botany Bay, was another possibility. But in Moll Flanders and in many of these early fictional treatments of shoplifters, shoplifters are not really there's a kind of ambiguous treatment of them. They're kind of rogues, you know, in a kind of attractive way. They're really not demonized as criminals. I mean,
except that you talk about one individual who was caught shoplifting 3 times, went to jail for the 3rd time. And what did that mean?
You mean today?
Yeah.
Today, you mean under the 3 strikes,
right,
in California? Is what yes. Well, that's right. Absolutely. I mean, that's something that is going on where in states that have 3 strikes, if one of the strikes can be a minor theft offense, and you can get, or you could get put away for 25.
Mm-hmm. For shoplifting.
If one of the strikes was shoplifting, yes, yes.
And the book we're talking about is titled The Steal by Rachel Steyer, A Cultural History of Shoplifting. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. If you've just joined us, we're talking about something I don't think we've ever talked about on this show before, shoplifting. We're talking with Rachel Steyer. She's written a new book called The Steal, A Cultural History of Shoplifting. She's the author of the award-winning Striptease, The Untold Story of the Girly Show, and Gypsy, The Art of the Tease. You can join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org and join us on Facebook and send us your tweets. Here's an email from Margaret in Ann Arbor, who says merchandise is arranged to be enticing, whether people have money or not. Most extreme are retailers who, though unmerciful to shoplifters, advertising using a theft motif, e.g. the big steal or criminally good deals, and in the past, steal it. What do you think of that?
I mean, she's absolutely right to say that. First of all, yes, of course, retailers want you in their store to buy things. Of course, they do not want you to steal things, but there is a science to enticing you. And they also, of course, use the word a steal to advertise.
How much impact does shoplifting have on sales margins?
That varies from year to year. I mean, I can talk about it really in terms of the losses to stores in billions of dollars. So in 2010, the most recent statistic is that stores in America lost $12 billion.
$12 billion through shoplifting.
Yes.
But you also write that, oddly enough, bad economic times don't seem to put a spike on shoplifting.
They sometimes do, but not enough is known about the relationship between the overall economy and why people are shoplifting. That's what I would say about
having
it.
Written this book, do you think that there is any merit to the notion that shoplifting is a psychological disorder?
Absolutely.
For how many of those, or what percentage of those who shoplift?
The numbers that I have read about that say that up to, I believe, 10% of all shoplifters are kleptomaniacs. And I believe the statistics for how much kleptomaniacs cost stores that I have read are $500 million a year.
So kleptomania, which really drives an individual to shoplift despite the risk of being caught, is something that is ongoing and pervasive.
Yes, I would say so. Yes, its shape has changed since the 19th century. In the 19th century, the Freudians believe that it arose out of female sexual repression. We no longer believe that today. Mostly now, it's considered an impulse control disorder. And there's a variety of treatments that have been tested for it.
And they probably use drugs along the way to help control those
yes.
feelings.
Yes.
How much do retailers have to set aside money for guards, for people to infiltrate their stores so they can watch plainclothes people watching customers?
Yes, you're asking me how much do stores spend
have
on security
to, sure.
per year?
Yeah.
It's in the billions, I can tell you
Again,
that much. Yes.
In the billions.
It's a growth industry.
So if the inability to pay, a la the celebrities, is not the fundamental motive for shoplifting, is it simply, I want that and I don't want to pay for it?
I think that's a good deal of it. I think it can be any number. We could go down. It can be entitlement. It can be, I don't want to pay for it. It can be an anxiety impulse control disorder. It can be a sense of, I have been wronged and now I am going to do a wrong. You know, there's a number of different things that can make someone shoplift.
And what about children? Is it they who begin early and then continue, or you have on the cover a beautifully dressed woman in a hat and gloves and earrings? Doesn't look like a kid who needs anything to me.
Yes. So I think one of the things that's interesting about shoplifting is that we have an idea that it's primarily done by women and children. That is not the case, according to the most recent research. The most recent research actually shows that middle-aged men are the primary shoplifters. Children, of course, do shoplift. Any parent, you know, probably many parents can tell you stories of that. But many researchers will tell you that children shoplifting does not necessarily mean anything, particularly if they're in the early stages. It can just be a developmental thing of the kid trying to figure out, you know, who am I and what is this? It doesn't mean they're going to grow up to be a burglar or jewel thief.
Unless it's habitual.
Yes, unless it's habitual.
Because did you ever experience the desire to shoplift as a child?
Of course.
So did I in the dime store.
The dime store, exactly. The dime stores are gone, though.
The dime stores are gone, but my conscience and the feeling always that my mother knew exactly everything I was doing, whether she was present or not, prevented me from taking that little whatever it was. What stopped you?
I did shoplift as a child.
Oh, you did?
Yes. My mother didn't always prevent me from doing it. Yes. I shoplifted some gum from a dime store.
And did your mother know that you shoplifted?
I think my mother will know now that we're on the radio.
She will know now, dear mom. Okay. We've got lots of callers. I want to open the phones here. First to Cincinnati, Ohio. Bernard's on the line. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I wanted to ask a question. Why is it that shoplifting has a lesser punishment than somebody else walking to the bank and also demanding money, whether the person used a gun or not? Because I think they are both stealing.
Yes. The question is about why does shoplifting have a lesser punishment than robbing a bank? It's an excellent question. The punishment for shoplifting varies from state to state, and it has to do with what is the dollar amount you've shoplifted and how many times you've done it previously and whether you're in a gang or not and whether you have shoplifting paraphernalia or not. I'm not really answering your question because I think you're making a good observation. It often is punished very little.
What about stealing something from someone's home that you go to visit? Do you regard that as a kind of shoplifting?
You mean as a burglary, or let's say you're over at their house for dinner
you're there for their house for dinner.
Yeah, you slip something in. I don't talk about that at all in the book. I mean, I really limit the book to stores, but that is certainly, it's in the same spectrum, I would say.
Spectrum of behavior.
Yes. If you're at someone's house, your friend's house, and you slip their salt shaker in your pocket, for example.
It sounds as though you're saying that many people who are shoplifters don't see themselves as doing anything wrong.
Yes, I would say I think that's often the case.
They just regard it as a kind of entitlement.
I would feel more comfortable saying they feel that somewhere they have been wronged and they are taking to make the adjustment to compensate. I guess I would say it's a kind of compensatory behavior.
All right. Let's go to Southern Illinois. Good morning, Jay. You're on the air.
Hey, I used to shoplift when I was young and got caught when I was 16 and was basically told, if you do it again, you're going to turn 17 in 3 days and you'll be an adult. And that scared me bad enough to stop me. But my observation is, you keep talking about why do people steal steak instead of hamburger trying to feed a family. Well, a pound of meat goes the same distance no matter what kind of pound it is. And you're going to get in the same amount of trouble if you're stealing steak or beef. I mean, everywhere you're talking about degrees of it, punishment, the punishment's a dollar amount. So you're not going to walk into Walmart and steal $6,000 worth of stuff. And likewise, the Rogaine. If you have a child with you and you're shopping for your baby powder and and your shampoo and your soap for the family, well, it's a lot easier to pay for those, and they're a lot less suspicious of looking for a Rogaine in your pocket if you do it that way. That would explain why people steal high-end. Do they factor that into their observations or surveys or whatever at all?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
It's more of an observation. I'm sorry.
Saying, you're saying
if you're going to steal, why steal, you know, the cheap hamburger value pound when a pound of steak is the same size, basically, and if it's flat, it's going to be easier to hide in your pants.
Yeah, same danger.
I see. More value.
Exactly.
You're getting, I would say the phrase getting something for nothing comes to my mind from this question. Yes, you're stealing something that's a bigger value for the risk. Sure, I agree with that.
Yeah. Rachel Steyer, and her new book is titled The Steal, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. To Angela in Broward County, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Fine, thanks.
Well, this is not funny, but I'm just laughing to hear all the stories. And if I know it, if somebody was going to write a book, I would sit down with her a long time ago. I've been in the business, on retail business, on the huge corporations for the last past 7 years. And I keep saying that this is created by reparations themselves.
Reparations, yeah.
Side job, I keep saying that. They have the thing of hiring people for part-timers for seasonals, and they don't care much to go buy ground. So when you have people that are really into this type of thing, so high-end designers, jewelry, perfumes, high shoes, you know, clothing, whatever, you know, they have the groups. They have groups that specialize on robbing the stores and disturbing the atmosphere and getting everything out of there, but putting someone of them inside of the store. That person is getting paid not only by the store, but also by the people who are stealing. Every time someone comes and steals something from the store, that person is looking all the way around.
Angela, let me ask you, have you had personal experience with this?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We have a lot of personal experience in this, you know, and I keep saying this, and every time that I stop someone, you know, who is stealing, the first thing is they don't ask, the corporate says, oh, you cannot tell them, give me the thing that you have it in your bag. You know, you mm-hmm. have to say customer service. Mm-hmm. You know, what else mm-hmm. can I help you? You know, maybe you can get a bag that goes well with the pair of shoes that you might like, you know, maybe that you have inside of your bag or you're wearing already. You know, things like this. But if that person wants to say, oh, that associate is harassing me is a bigger word. The corporations don't want to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you bring up an excellent point, which I talk about in the second half of the book, which is what has stores' response been to shoplifting? And, you know, you're certainly right to say that stores have this difficulty. They want to provide customer service to their customers, obviously. But on the other hand, they want to prevent people from shoplifting from them. And it's sometimes an uneasy balance. And, I agree with you. I don't know what the solution is. What I do know is that I have seen in my research since the 70s, there has been more and more and more security. And I don't think it's really having a pronounced effect, a profound effect in stopping.
You know, that's interesting because, of course, more and more stores, whether they're low-end, high-end, put these tags on pieces of clothing or, you know, you try on a pair of shoes, and I guess if the salesperson turns away, you might walk out with that pair of shoes. But on the other hand, getting out of a store with all these mirrors around, with all these both plain clothes security and clothes security, I mean, you're saying it's not working.
It's sometimes working. It's only as good as the people who are working it, for one thing. In terms of the cameras, for example, there have been studies shown that sometimes CCTV camera, which is what's in the stores, actually increases crime.
How so?
Well, there are two things. One is that it gets more reported because, of course, shoplifting is hugely underreported. So CCTV just seeing what's going on inside the store. And then sometimes it's true that CCTV might deter somebody in that particular store, but they'll just go to the next store. I mean, if they're determined to shoplift. So it can have a moving along effect.
Rachel Steyer, and her new book is titled The Steal, A Cultural History of Shoplifting. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, more of your calls and comments.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. By the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Dr. Paul Farmer has spent 30 years treating the poor in Haiti, Rwanda, Russia, and elsewhere. He was appointed the UN Deputy Special Envoy to Haiti.
One thing we have to acknowledge is that if you look at Haiti, many billions of dollars have gone into development aid there that have not been effective.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Farmer, his new book is Haiti After the Earthquake. Join us.
Welcome back. Rachel Steyer is with me. She has a new book out, A Cultural History of Shoplifting, and it's titled basically The Steal. If you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Here's an email from Antonia. Is there any correlation between compulsive gamblers and shoplifters?
Definitely, yes, absolutely. Those are both considered to be, by some medical researchers, behavioral addictions. In other words, substance addictions are alcohol and drug addiction, but gambling and shoplifting are considered to be addictions that create or result in behavior.
So where did you come down? Did you come down on the side of prosecuting shoplifters or treating shoplifters?
Oh, well, I think that people who are compulsive shoplifters need help. I don't think that they should necessarily be thrown in with the general population in prisons. Sometimes they really, there were many people I spoke to who really are compelled to shoplift.
But you're not talking about the gangs of people
No.
who move in.
No, although I will tell you something about the gangs of people. I interviewed a number of the individuals in those gangs. And what I can say is that when they talked about shoplifting and what it was like, what it felt like. It was not all that different from the way people who are compulsive shoplifters talked about it. In other words, yes, those gangs are shoplifting for profit. They're making money. They're selling their stuff on eBay.
But they're feeling the
rush. But they feel the rush in the store. They said to me things like, it's better than heroin. You know, it's the thrill is more exciting than drugs. They talked about their techniques. You know, which people who were
such as
compelled. You know, I mean, some of them use those booster bags and booster coats, which are bags and coats lined with foil or other materials that disarm the sensor tags from going off. You know, others have put shields on the cameras or the mirrors, you know, they so they block them. I mean, there's many, many different ways of doing it.
Here's a tweet from a listener who says, Walmart makes billions in profits every year. I don't shoplift, but I can see how someone can justify the act. Big corporations, no sympathy from the individual watching someone else shoplift?
Yes. I mean, I write about that in the book, both in the Abby Hoffman chapter and then in the chapter on what I call the ethical shoplifters, the people who are doing what the tweeter describes. I think there definitely is a feeling that the little guy is not getting it, not getting enough, that they're being denied, that they're being prohibited. And this is the little guy's way to somehow even the stakes.
By stealing.
By stealing, you know. I'm not justifying it. I'm just
understand.
Describing. Yeah.
So here's Linda in Medina, Ohio. Good morning, Linda.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I listen to you both hours every single day. I just love it.
Thank you.
But I was going to tell you, this is so silly. When I was like 12 or 13, my girlfriends and I was raised in Columbus, Ohio, and I went to Catholic schools all my life. And my girlfriends, I would run, we'd take our bikes, and we'd go up to the Five and Dime, and I would take a little bit of money. I had a little allowance, and I would go there to get some candy or something. And then I would see them stealing lip gloss or fingernail polish or something, and I would just put my stuff on the counter and run out of the store because I was so afraid of getting caught, and I didn't steal anything. But I'd run out of the store, so they started making fun of me, and they would call me Goody Two-Shoes. But I couldn't. I just couldn't risk it. My mother would know. The nuns would know.
Of course they would know.
I'd have to go to confession.
Yeah. Right.
I would never do that. I saved all my big sins for confession later in life. But it was really, really funny because they really did make fun of me. They were stealing like little nail polish. And
yeah.
Lip
I think that's a great story, Linda. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners feel as you do that somebody was looking over their shoulder. Let's go to Anne in Silver Spring, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say when you mentioned the tags for security, I have bought so many things that when I got home, I discovered they had left the tags on them.
Oh, right.
I don't know how those work anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was calling to say is that I'm 50 years old, and I never did the little shoplifting thing when my friends did when I was a kid. But since I have gone from being a homeowning, well-paid professional to the last 4 years looking for a job, and at this point I'm on food stamps, still looking for a job, I have been shoplifting high-end face cream samples, though. I don't actually take the things in the boxes. I only take the samples, but these are things I wouldn't pay $50 for when I had the money because why would I pay $50 for eye cream? But just in, you know, the last year or so, I will be going to actually buy a mascara, and I'll see these fancy French whatevers, and I will slip the sample into my pocket. And it is, as you said, this feeling of, you know, I've done everything I was supposed to do. I went to graduate school, and, you know, at least my face should look good, even if I haven't been able to buy an item of clothing in 2 years. Mm-hmm. And it's weird because I don't condone shoplifting. And, you know, I knew people who shoplifted when I was growing up, and I was appalled by it. But for some reason, I keep thinking, well, it's samples, you know, they get it free anyway.
Right, right.
But at the same time, it's like, you know, come on now. You're walking into a store and risking this, and I've
But, Anne, you know, I'm not sure, considering, as you've already said, that these things, I presume, are on the counter. They are samples. Perhaps they're inviting you to take those samples.
Well, they are, but at the same time, they have to replace. I mean, you know, they only get, I've worked in retail when I was growing up.
Yeah.
They certainly only get a certain number of samples. I mean, these are full-size things. I'm not talking about the little package samples that they give you.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a little different. I'm just not sure about that. It sort of reminds Marcia, who has emailed us, what about the people who graze in the produce section of the grocery store?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see people sort of picking up a bunch, not one grape, but a bunch of grapes and eating those before he or she gets out of the store. Isn't that the same thing?
I mean, I have heard stories of stores detaining people for grazing. That is called grazing.
Where? In New York?
Because
I've never seen that happen here in the Washington area.
I've definitely read about incidences of it in news clippings and so on while I was doing my research. On the other hand, it's a sort of gray area. It strikes me as a gray area, right? I mean, it's...
Well, one can argue if you want to see how good the grapes are, you taste a grape.
Yes.
You don't take a bunch of grapes, which is why many stores have now come to wrap those grapes in packages.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to the other side of this discussion. And to Chris, who's in Quincy, Massachusetts, good morning to you. Hey, Chris, are you there? Well, Chris must have changed his mind because he works in security at a clothing store, concerned with the image of the store so they don't stop shoplifters.
Yeah, absolutely.
And take it as a tax write-off.
Mm-hmm.
So you and I are paying for that.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how many stores there are like that.
I don't know about that, but there are certainly stores that discourage their customer service or salespeople from detaining shoplifters.
Well, what are they there for?
Well, they're there to help the customers. Right. I mean, I think the earlier caller who talked about the possible lawsuits that might ensue if somebody gets hurt, if a shoplifter gets hurt in the store, that can then deflect boomerang back to the store.
Boy, let's go to Syracuse, New York. Good morning, Debbie.
Yes. Hi. Good morning. Great show.
Thanks.
Back years ago when I was in college, I worked as a store detective for a local low-end department store.
Mm-hmm.
And the standards we had for being allowed to stop a shoplifter were very high.
Mm-hmm.
We had to actually see the person physically conceal the merchandise. If they just had it in their hand, walked around a corner, and then didn't have it, we couldn't stop them.
Mm-hmm.
We had to physically see them conceal it and then attempt to leave the store.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we caught more kids. We caught more teenagers because their body language gave them away. let's see, the professionals, they knew how to, you know, there was a look that a shoplifter gets.
Right.
They get a look, and that's who we would follow.
What was that look?
Nervousness, looking around, you know, standing in a rack of CDs, and they kind of look around real suspiciously.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when you know they're getting ready to shove it down their pants.
Their pants. The shifty eyes, you're saying.
It's the eyes.
The body
language.
The body language.
I see that look today when I'm in stores. You know, I say, oh, that person's getting ready to go.
Interesting. How long did you do that kind of work, Debbie?
I did that for a couple of years, and as a matter of fact, when I left, my last bust was an 80-year-old man who stole a bottle of aspirin,
mm-hmm.
and he started crying when I detained him.
Oh, my God.
And
wow.
I said, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore.
Oh, jeez.
Wow.
And now I'm an artist.
Thanks for sharing with us, Debbie, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I know a lot of grocery stores and other department stores are doing the self-checkouts now. I was just wondering if there's any effect on the maybe increase or decrease theft through the self-checkouts.
That is an excellent question, and I haven't read any statistics on that, but I anecdotally hear that there is an increase, and one reason that I've heard is that customers get very frustrated at the self-checkout, you know, when something doesn't scan or something like that, and then they just put it in their bag and be done with it. And I have heard also that some stores are considering discontinuing self-checkout for that reason.
Interesting. Yeah. Our local CVS has that kind of self-checkout, as does the local supergiant. Let's go to Andy in Prince George's County, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air. Andy, are you there? Let's try that again.
Yes.
Are you there, sir? Go right ahead.
Yes. You know, I'm struck, just sort of a follow-up, I'm struck by the issue of the psychology of deterrence. A large big-box retail store that I occasionally patronize has staff that work the one exit, and they have their Sharpie pen in hand, and they check every single receipt against shopping carts leaving the building. Anyway, it just seems so completely theatrical and formulaic, and they barely pretend to be paying any real attention. And I wondered about the placebo value of security. And I have a short follow up after I get a comment from your guest.
Yes, there is a placebo value to security, the thing Diane has spoken of about somebody watching you, just that sense.
My own mother.
Her mother, exactly. Who could better watch anybody than their mother? So that is why, actually, there are greeters in stores. One of their function is to deter shoplifters.
But, you know, Andy spoke about what's in the basket going out, but it's not all in the basket.
It's not all in the basket. But Andy, I don't know about, you know, the particular stores you're talking about, but I would say that thing of big box stores checking people's receipts, that is in direct response to shoplifting. I mean, that didn't exist, say, I don't know, 10 years ago.
One last question for you, Rachel. And whether racial profiling has been used an awful lot.
Yes, it has been. I talk about it in the book. And I think it also speaks to something that the earlier caller was saying about how she used behavior to discover when someone was shoplifting, as opposed to any particular idea of race, gender, age, or whatever. Most criminologists agree that the way to tell if someone is shoplifting is through these series of behavioral tells, not through any race, gender, age, anything. So those things have certainly profiling has been used in the past. The industry is trying to certainly downplay and phase it out.
So you've had big stores, even, the biggest department stores being really accused of racial profiling.
Yes, shopping while black. Everybody knows that phrase. And
I hope your book helps people to understand that that's really changed a lot. Rachel Steyer, her new book is The Steal, A Cultural History of Shoplifting. Her last name, by the way, is spelled S-H-T-E-I-R. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Katie June Friesen answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.